Good evening, everyone. I'm David Cohen, and I want to welcome my friend and schemer and conspirator and colleague, Michael Waldman, back to Politics and Prose. This is his fifth book. It's his third time here for his books, and he even wrote one in the coffee shop. And this is a very timely topic. This was a Supreme Court decision day. I'm sure Michael will have some comments on some of the Second Amendment decisions as he gives us a biography of the Second Amendment and navigates us through it. Politics and Prose continues to be timely, relevant, and adds to civil discourse. Lissa Muscatine is here. It's under great leadership. You've heard me say that numerous times. I'm going to keep saying it because it's true. So here we are dealing with the biography of the Second Amendment, in which someone said, an individual right to own a gun is a fraud. So this isn't Michael, and it isn't some of the activists like me. It's Chief Justice Berger. So I think we should take Chief Justice Berger seriously, at least this time. And I'm sure Michael will go through this, that the Constitutional Convention, the congressional debates, if you're an originalist, individual rights to control, to own guns, doesn't come from that. Michael has a wonderful phrase in the book. It's called misremembered history. And this is a reminder that sometimes the Supreme Court doesn't get the history right either. So we the people, this is the way the Constitution begins. The Second Amendment dealt with guns, with people as a group rather than individual rights. The example was to defend the homeland, not to defend home and hearth. And this becomes a very rich book on history and how we can navigate the Second Amendment so that we can find ways of having some sensible policies on guns. Michael always is able to come up with a nugget, and he found one and actually checked it out and didn't rely just on a magazine report. And that is the NRA posts the Second Amendment in its lobby, in its foyer. But in classic Orwell fashion, they managed to leave out all the stuff about the militia. And a well-regulated militia is part of the Second Amendment. That they left out, so they will get our Orwell Award for misinformation. Let's welcome Michael Waldman again to Politics and Prose.
Well, thank you all. It is thrilling for me to be here among old friends with so many old friends in what I really am confident is the best bookstore in the United States. It's, first of all, a great thrill for me to be introduced by David Cohen. These days, I run the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and every day I use lessons taught to me and generations of public interest lawyers by David. Unfortunately still worked with David decades ago on campaign finance reform and still work on it, which is why I needed something else on my resume. So, you know, this picked an easy topic like the Second Amendment. It is great to be here. It's not only where I wrote at least one book in the cafe downstairs. I think of Tuna Melt whenever I see that book. It's where my kids at a young age waited well past their bedtime for the next Harry Potter book. It's where I spent many, many hours, and it is a thrill that my old friend and colleague Lissa Muscatine is taking this into the next era, and we're all appreciative. I should also acknowledge and thank Becca Giederman, who worked with me on the book last summer as a law student. You know, as they say in all the acknowledgments, the errors are mine. But she was extraordinarily helpful, and I want to thank you. The question with this that I hoped to address with this book is, at some basic level, how does legal change happen in America? How does it really happen? And we all know the Second Amendment. It's only 27 words long. It is the shortest sentence in the Constitution. It reads in its entirety, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, it being necessary to... Hello? Any better?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting. My future as a rock star is diminished. necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. We're all familiar with that convoluted and clotted and somewhat confusing provision. What a lot of people don't realize, even aficionados are surprised to learn, that the Supreme Court of the United States never ruled that that Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership until 2008. It's really recent. And in fact, it had ruled otherwise repeatedly before that. So the question on my mind was, how did that happen? Why did that happen? How do we understand what the Constitution means at any moment? We began working on this book actually in the wake of Newtown, when we as a country, for the first time, were debating gun violence and gun control and gun safety laws, as we had not in almost two decades, but this time for the first time with that constitutional right now enshrined by the Supreme Court. And it turns out, not surprisingly, that the way we understand that provision, as we understand all provisions, is not due to some pristine text, but due to the push and pull, the rough and tumble of political organizing, public debate, and partisan agitation. That's the story of the Second Amendment, and in many, many ways, it's the story of the whole Constitution. When Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that 2008 opinion, as you probably know, it was called District of Columbia versus Heller. It struck down the law of the District of Columbia prohibiting people, in effect, from having a loaded handgun in the home. It was his first big opinion that he wrote as a Supreme Court justice after many years on the bench. And he said later very proudly that it was the high point, the vindication of his philosophy, of his judicial approach of originalism. The idea that the only legitimate way to understand a constitutional provision is to say what it meant at the time that it was ratified and written to the framers and to their generation. So in looking at the history of the Second Amendment, what it meant, how it changed, and what it means now, I started back then. The book actually starts at Lexington and Concord. And it turns out that there were a number of surprises all the way through. Things that surprised me, things I would suggest that might surprise liberals and surprise conservatives, that might surprise people who consider themselves gun rights advocates and people focused more on the toll of gun violence or seeking stronger gun laws. The first surprise was that that well-regulated militia was not throat-clearing, but was incredibly important to the framers. It starts at Lexington and Concord because that was a battle fought by those militias, the Minutemen. The militias were not just the military force of the time. They were at the center of the political philosophy of the framers. Now, what were those militias? They're not like anything we have now. They're not like anything we know now. They're not like the National Guard. The militia of the time was every adult man, and eventually every adult white man, was in the militia their entire adult life. And they were required by law to own a gun and keep it at home and bring it in for the militia service. It was kind of a universal draft. They saw the militias as being a bulwark, above all else, against political tyranny. What they were really terrified of was what they called a standing army. That's what King George had. That's what the Redcoats were. a professional military force at the command of the king that they saw as kind of fascism in the making. The militias were their way of fighting that off. And when they started the revolution, as you know, they used the militias. They didn't actually work that well. They didn't fight that well. A lot of the people who fought the revolution were in the Continental Army and became to believe that they needed something else. But they paid great reverence to it in public. The country began to fall apart after the revolution. We all know the story. The people who became the founders, the framers, went into secret to debate and came out with the U.S. Constitution, the proposed Constitution. It emphatically thrust toward a much stronger central government. That was its purpose. And as we know, it was massively controversial. The release of the Constitution prompted a roaring debate and tremendous opposition. People were afraid of this new strong central government. And one of the things they were afraid of was that it had and could have a standing army. And they were very afraid that that standing army could crush the 13 state militias, which they regarded as their bulwark of liberty. That was actually one of the themes of the debates. And so, as we know, they moved through the states to get it ratified. Eventually, there began to be the idea that there would be amendments recommended by the states at the same time. The states sent dozens of amendments in to be considered, and the Constitution got ratified. That fear of a standing army, that reverence for the militias, those amendments and that political brawl to get the Constitution ratified directly produced the Second Amendment. Now, James Madison is an interesting character, as I learned throughout all of this. As we know, he was the originator of much of the Constitution. He was seen as the father of the Constitution. He was the organizer of the campaign to get it passed. He was against having a Bill of Rights. He was, as we would say now, he was against the Bill of Rights before he was for it. He actually was changed his view in the very first congressional election out in Virginia. It was the first gerrymandered congressional district long before Elbert Gerry put his name on that practice. To win the race, basically the only part of the district that was pro-Constitution was his house. They ran a charismatic, not too bright war hero against him, James Monroe. The issue was the Constitution. And the swing vote in the district were the Baptists. They were, at the time, an oppressed religious minority. They were oppressed by the Episcopalians. And they said, we will only vote for you if you change your position and come out for a religious freedom amendment. So Madison did the first great epical flip-flop in American political history, said, well, I was against the amendments. Now everything's changed, and here's why it's different, in language that tens of thousands of politicians have copied less eloquently since then. He came out for a Bill of Rights and vowed to pass it. He won by 339 votes, and he went to Congress and fought, had to overcome people's unwillingness to do it, proposed 20 amendments, ranging from congressional pay to the size of congressional districts to what we know as the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment was the fifth, was number five. And as we try to squint at this history and learn from what they were debating and what they thought they were doing, as we try to follow Justice Scalia's instruction that the only way to understand the Constitution is to go back in time and try to understand what they were thinking, it can be somewhat daunting. It's very hard to pierce the fog of history to fully know what they meant by the Second Amendment. But the striking fact is this: every note from Madison's notes at the Constitutional Convention, all the records of the ratification conventions, with a few scattered exceptions, and every word spoken on the floor of the House of Representatives as they marked up and debated in public the Second Amendment, there's not a single word about an individual right to gun ownership for hunting or self-protection or any of the things we talk about now. It was all about the militias. In fact, Madison's original proposal had a conscientious objector clause. It said, if you have religious scruples about bearing arms, you don't have to do your military service in person. So I'm asked all the time, well, was it an individual right or is it a militia? What is it you're saying? And the real answer is it was both and it was neither. It was an individual right, in their minds, to fulfill the civic duty to serve in the militia. Our question to them would make no sense, just the same way their answer to us in some ways makes no sense. Now, I want to be really clear. There were plenty of guns. There weren't as many as we think there were, probably, but there were plenty of guns, and they felt they had a right, an expectation of being able to defend themselves, especially in their homes. That was a right that came down through English common law, through court decisions, and through Blackstone, the jurist Blackstone's writings. But at the same time as they had that right, there were myriad gun laws, tons of gun safety and gun control laws of a kind that would surprise us now. It was illegal to keep a loaded gun in your home in Boston because of safety. You couldn't fire a gun within the city limits of Philadelphia and other cities. Lots of states had prohibitions on who could own a gun. You had to have loyalty oaths and things like that. There were numerous gun registries and gun registration schemes. In the middle of ratification, the state of Pennsylvania recalled all the guns in the state for cleaning. You know, they said they were rusty. A web of gun laws simultaneous with the self-defense right of common law. But in any case, that doesn't seem, from the contemporary records, to be what they thought they were putting in the Constitution. That was all a surprise, and it really is a reminder that it was a different world than what we live in now. That world of a universal draft is a different world. Well, what happened after that? Very quickly, the militias began to crumble. People stopped showing up. They grew more individualistic, more commercial. They moved west. The militias didn't work, so they were supposed to be this civil defense force of the country. Then the War of 1812 happened. The British marched through Maryland past the 7,000 militiamen in Maryland, brushed right past them, and burned down James Madison's house. After that, they didn't think the militias were such a good idea to defend the country. And over time, we grew away from that original understanding. The militias vanished, the original meaning of the Second Amendment vanished with it. Instead, we had guns and gun rights, and simultaneously we had gun laws growing throughout the country's history. In the Wild West, which we think of as six-shooter territory, there's a wonderful photograph from Dodge City, the archetypal frontier town. It's from the 1880s. It looks like a movie set, like you're on the Universal Studios tour. It's a dusty main street, and there's saloon doors and hitching posts. In the middle of the street, it says, "Welcome to Dodge City, firearms prohibited." Even in Dodge City, that's how we grew up as a country. And all through it, the courts stayed out. The Supreme Court repeatedly declined to rule that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right. In fact, ruled otherwise on at least one significant occasion. And as David said, by 1991, retired Chief Justice Warren Burger said the idea that the Second Amendment recognized an unlimited individual right to gun ownership was a, quote, fraud on the public. So what happened? What happened? Well, it turns out that what happened is what always happens in American history. What happened was the NRA got involved and changed over many decades how we read this important constitutional provision. Now, the NRA has been around for a long time. It was started after the Civil War by Union officers who were worried about marksmanship, poor shooting by the soldiers. It dealt with training, marksmanship, military preparedness. Eventually, it spoke for hunters. It was never wild about gun laws, but it didn't actually lobby against them very hard. Cut to the 1970s. We all know about the 1960s and the social turmoil and changes then. Turns out that the backlash to the 1960s, really strongly felt in the late 1970s, has shaped all of our lives much more than we realize. That was true with the NRA. They announced that they were moving their headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado to signal a further retreat from politics. At their annual meeting, known to this day as the Revolt at Cincinnati, 1,000 activists showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership. That was much more dogmatic, much more intense, and focused on making and reshaping the NRA into a constitutional crusade around the Second Amendment. So that David's right, that what used to be on the wall of the building of the NRA was about training and marksmanship. Now you walk in, you go to the headquarters in Fairfax, and there on the wall is, in pride of place, is the Second Amendment. But they've edited it. They just edited out the part about the militia. And there are two dots. There's not even three dots. And it's exactly right that we'd read about this, and Becca will remember this. We read about this, and it was in a magazine article, and said, wow, this is great. This is so novelistic. It's, you know, it's so perfect. Wait a minute. What if it's not true? You know, that's an easy one to disprove. It's in your lobby. So our colleague went there and heroically went to the gift shop to buy T-shirts and hats and take a picture of the wall to make sure that it was still the case. And it was still the case. And we have the hats. What did the NRA do? Well, they did what people have done to wage and win constitutional change throughout the country's history. They started with scholarship. Some of it quite good. A lot of it, I have suggested, very surprisingly flimsy. Scholarship to show what they really meant back in those days. I kept finding things that were, they reminded me of the people who write movie posters, you know, plucking quotes out of context. One of them, there were quite a few, but one that stuck out was Thomas Jefferson. There's a quote from Thomas Jefferson that's in numerous law review articles, scholarly law review articles. He says, one loves to possess arms, though one hopes never to have to use them. This is in these articles to show what the framers meant by the Second Amendment. It's still on the NRA website. Wow, that's a good one. Well, now you can look it all up on the internet. What Jefferson was actually saying was, he was writing a letter to George Washington. He said, remember when I was Secretary of State, I made that decision that was controversial? And I sent you that packet of letters. I think I'm going to get criticized for that decision. Could you send me back the letters? One loves to possess arms, though one hopes never to have to use them. That's what he was saying. It's still in scholarly articles, it's still on the website, and you can still buy a T-shirt online now with this proving that this is what they meant. There's far too much of that. So they did scholarship. They moved public opinion so that over time, the public view shifted pretty dramatically. So it's now the common sense, widespread view that, of course, the Second Amendment reflects an individual right. They elected politicians, we all know that, but they moved the organs of government. The Justice Department, which had long taken the position that this was not about an individual right, shifted its view. And then and only then, the NRA and other gun rights backers went to court. And so that when that D.C. versus Heller case went to court, eventually, when it went to the Supreme Court, it fell like a ripe apple from the tree. It wasn't all that controversial. And that is, I should say, the story of constitutional change in the United States. It's not all that different. You might like it, you might not like it. It's not different, really, from what the Civil Rights Movement did. It's not different from what's happening, in my view, with marriage equality. It's not different from what groups like the Brennan Center work on voting, trying to move public opinion as a precursor for legal change. Anyway, that's what the NRA did. So this was a pretty epical decision, this D.C. versus Heller decision. Well, what does it mean, and what has been the consequence? That's sort of the third surprise. So strip away all the finery, all the pretense of it being originalist. Scalia's opinion, 64 pages, only two of the 64 pages actually deal with what the framers thought they were talking about, which was militias. The rest is words taken out of context, out of order. He used a lot of dictionaries. It's like a Scrabble player trying really hard to prove that that triple score word really exists. Take all that stuff away. What was the actual holding of the Heller case? It said there's an individual right, but like all individual rights, it can be limited. It didn't say how far the right extended. It didn't say what those limits could be. It mentioned some, but it didn't really say what they were. And so that has then been up to the courts and all of us to decide. And the surprise there is there have been dozens and dozens of cases brought all over the country in federal and state court, but in federal court. And overwhelmingly, the courts have upheld gun laws. They've said, yes, it's an individual right, some enthusiastically, some grudgingly. Yes, it's an individual right, but society, too, has a right to protect itself. The government has a compelling interest in strong gun laws. Now, that's not necessarily a permanent equilibrium. One of the issues that hasn't been fully resolved is the very big issue of carrying guns outside the home. What are the rights that we have for carrying guns outside the home? There is a circuit split that might be emerging, which, as you know, is when there's different federal appeals courts rule differently, and that's the kind of thing Supreme Courts like to take to hear. In the Ninth Circuit in California, of all places, which is considered the most liberal appeals court in the federal system, struck down California's gun law a few months ago. The law dealing with carrying guns, that may now be heard by a larger group of judges, by the full set of judges. That could conceivably go up to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court, interestingly, including in this term, has been very reluctant to hear more gun cases. They've turned down a lot of opportunities. Nobody's entirely sure why. Maybe they're comfortable with the consensus. The NRA says that this consensus is massive resistance. Just the same way the South resisted Brown versus Board of Education. But the real surprise is that it turns out that, properly conceived, the kinds of gun laws that really work, that really make a difference, can survive and be allowed even under this doctrine that the Heller case gives us. Last year, in the wake of Newtown, when Congress debated background checks for the first time in a long time, you know, the Manchin-Toomey bipartisan bill, it was defeated. It had a majority of the Senate. It was defeated not because of the Second Amendment, not even really because it wasn't popular. It was had 90% approval from the public, but because of the filibuster rules in the Senate. It had a majority of the Senate. In other words, very few people really argued that that proposal violated the Second Amendment, even those who were against it. So is that a note for hope? Well, there actually is some hope on this. While it's true that the number of guns in this country is almost 300 million. It's almost 300 million guns. Nobody's taking away the guns, even if they wanted to. The share of the population that owns guns is shrinking pretty rapidly. And the gun violence is actually going down, too. The actual rate of gun crime is going down all over the country, too. There are things that are happening and being done that may take some of the steam out of this issue. There are technological fixes also that could have a significant impact. I was very struck recently by a statistic that I learned right after the book came out, not during the writing of the book. This year, more people will be killed in the United States by guns than by cars. 33,000 people. Now that's, at one level, a terrifying statistic. It's much higher than in other civilized countries. A lot of it's suicide, not all outer directed violence, but nonetheless, that's obviously a painful high number. But what's really noteworthy is, why aren't more people killed by cars? Used to be a lot more people would be killed by cars. The real reason for that statistic is the number of people killed by cars has gone down and down. Now, why is that? They didn't ban cars. They didn't seize cars. They didn't take away your right to drive. They made cars safer. They put in airbags. They put in seatbelts. They raised the drinking age. They lowered the speed limit. They put in all this crash prevention technology and actually made cars a lot safer. And there are technological things like that that can be done to make guns safer so they don't fall in the wrong hands, so that children aren't able to use them, so that you can trace more easily when a criminal uses a gun. My worry is that now that this idea of an unfettered and misremembered individual right has been articulated in this loud voice by the Supreme Court, that Second Amendment fundamentalism, whatever the caveats and conditions the court put on it, that Second Amendment fundamentalism takes on a life of its own and could intrude on the kinds of common sense laws, regulations, and technological improvements that could really make a difference on this. I'm asked, as you can imagine, by folks who care a lot about this and who work on this, what to do, how to grapple with the power of the NRA, how to grapple with this issue. The answer to me is basically what the NRA did is in the great stream of how constitutional change happens in America. Those who want stronger gun laws have no choice but to do the same thing over many years with relentless patience, and to understand something that a great constitutional lawyer, Abraham Lincoln, said at another time of great turmoil over what the Constitution meant. This was in the first Lincoln-Douglas debate. He was talking about slavery, and he said, public opinion is everything. With public sentiment, anything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. Consequently, those who mold public sentiment have more power than judges or legislators because they make it possible for those judges or legislators to act. That's what the NRA did, and that's what those who want a different approach have to do, too. I hope the book helps enliven that conversation. Thank you.
We're gonna open it up for questions. Thank you, Michael. I think we got a tremendous discussion here on how constitutional change is made, and I hope you can weave in some of your answers on how the Brennan Center works, because this is one of the great hopes. Brennan is the Justice Brennan, and that's a perspective and a point of view, and it suggests, particularly by your referencing, in 2 days we'll have the 50th anniversary of President Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act. And it references how that change happened. The Civil Rights Act of 64 didn't just happen. Brown versus Board of Education didn't just happen. And so I think there are lessons in that, and I hope that the work, and I know that the work that the Brennan Center does, helps really vitalize democratic institutions, which is what your message is for how we begin to change on the Second Amendment. We'll rotate the microphones, and since this is a public meeting, please, if you're comfortable, please say your name. Michael, you take over.
Thank you.
Okay, Coralie Farley. Two things. I'm still trying to be an originalist, or my interpretation of one. There's no need to do your civic duty by owning a gun. We have lots of what I think of as militia, military and National Guard and police of all levels. So what's wrong with that argument? My second point is, or question, in terms of technological change, why can't we just ban ammunition, the sale of ammunition, except to those people I just mentioned?
Well, so in fact, Justice Stevens, who wrote the most lengthy dissent in the Heller case, has argued that we should change the Second Amendment to say that only people in the militia are eligible to have the right to bear arms. You know, I think it's a challenge, because I think that the reality is we don't have the militias now. And so to say that limiting gun ownership to people in the militia is the same thing as saying you limiting gun ownership. I think that what we can draw from that period more usefully, at least in my mind, is the idea that to the degree there was an individual expectation or right of gun ownership, it was for a public purpose, and it was bounded always by the public good. It was not just an expression of an empowered individual, but it was for the public purpose. And in those days, there were no police. There were no police force. There was no army, but there were also no cities. It is hard to fully draw from the institutions of that time to now. And I think that the question about the ammunition, you know, these are the kinds of things that the courts have not yet had to rule on. But I do think that if there were a something that were in effect a ban on guns or ban on commonly used guns, the court would say that that would be the kind of thing that would stand in the way of the Second Amendment, even if it were just the ammunition. However, the kinds of restrictions on magazines with 100 bullets in them, these kinds of things that are essentially weapons of war in private hands, those have been upheld by the courts. And I do think that those are the kinds of things that could diminish the terror of these mass shootings without running afoul even of this court.
My name is Rhoda Truboff. I've written some about the grammar of the Second Amendment. And surely the framers were well-schooled in the old grammar form, the absolute, nominative absolute or ablative absolute, of those first 13 words. And they knew that the absolute qualifies the main clause. They knew that the absolute answers questions like why, when, and under what conditions does the main clause apply. Why has so little been said recently by the Supreme Court and other commentators on all sides of this issue about the grammar of those 27 words.
Well, you're right that especially at the beginning of the country, those preambles had more force than they did later, in part because they were trying to persuade a broad public about the Constitution. I never thought I'd be quoting Latin grammarians in my footnotes, but I did. and you're right that that was a form of sentence that, generally speaking, at the time, the beginning conditioned the end rather than merely explaining it or being throat clearing, as Scalia seemed to argue. He quoted other grammatical sources, but they were from a later time. Originalism, in my view, tends to be used as an outcome determinative thing. It's a, you know, text without context is can be a pretext. If I could find my inner Jesse Jackson to coin something like that. There were a lot of another linguistic bit of learning that was ignored by the court is the way the words work together. So Scalia took the word keep and bear and arms out of context and out of sequence and looked them up in dictionaries to see what they meant. But the phrase bear arms in the founding period had an almost entirely military usage, which you can just last year, the National Archives put online the papers, all the papers of the six most prominent founders. And the phrase bear arms or bearing arms appears 153 times. And if you take out the ones where they say, hey, did you see we have a Second Amendment? Here's what it says. Every single one of them is a military usage about soldiers. So there was a lot of learning that was, I thought that Justice Stevens' dissent was better originalism, but I don't think we ought to be governing ourselves as a modern country just, even if I thought it was the right answer, I don't think the way to govern a country is just by asking what they meant back then as opposed to how has the country evolved since then and what do we need as a country right now.
I hope I can do this. My name's Terry Miller. I have two questions. You mentioned that in the 1970s, the NRA changed the focus of their organization to articulate for the first time an individual right to bear arms. Why? What was the motivation for that? What was the benefit of this huge shift that has affected us so over the many decades? A second question, yes, is on Justice Scalia, of all the justices, I mean, the strongest originalist, how could he possibly have, how did he go about justifying the decision in Heller and call himself an originalist?
I will leave the second question to him when he comes to Politics and Prose for his next book. But the first question is about why, how did it happen that the NRA changed and focused this way? And as I talk in the book, it really was part of a much wider reaction to the liberalism of the courts and the liberalism of the 1960s across a whole array of mainstream American institutions. 1977, 78, 79, you also saw the evangelical churches move from to a very conservative view. The Baptists had voted for Jimmy Carter in 1976, and by 1980 you had the moral majority. The farm groups out in the West had the Sagebrush Rebellion. You had the tax revolt in California, all this insurrectionist language. The business lobbies, which had been this quiet, plushly carpeted institution giving money to both Democrats and Republicans, became a much more ideological and intense force. All these institutions moved to the right, and they began to move together and actually became more partisan, became more part of a Republican coalition. A lot of it comes down to people's attitudes toward government, or if you want to look at it, a libertarianism. It turns out, when you look at the way people focused on the Second Amendment all through history, it has more to do with their attitude toward government and individual rights vis-a-vis government than anything else, in my view.
Thank you.
Sure.
Ken Button, two quick ones. One is that given that the Supreme Court had dealt with the Second Amendment a number of times in the past, how did Justice Scalia and the majority rationalize a change making things different than they had been for centuries. And then secondly, quickly, you criticized Justice Scalia's opinion in terms of its view of history. How do you rate that of Justice Stevens in his dissent?
The way that Justice Scalia, in the opinion, dealt with previous Supreme Court decisions is kind of the way lawyers do it. They distinguished it. They insisted they were not overturning anything. It's really hard to argue when you actually read the other opinions, in particular the 1939 case of Miller, which upheld the first federal gun law and went through all the same history, talked about all the same historic sources, just came to a very different view. Now, again, that was at a time when people had a different view about the role of the government. It was also kind of, the Miller case was kind of a crazy case. It involved a bank robber and sawed-off shotguns and getaway cars, and the case seems to have been something of a setup because the judge, at the lower court judge there, maybe was actually pro-gun control but struck down the federal gun law. So it was, there's some kind of picturesque qualities to Miller, but they just said, well, we're just distinguishing it. And I've had the chance in talking about the book in a number of different platforms to be with some of the attorneys who argued these cases. And it was at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia with Alan Gura, who's a lawyer who argued the Heller case. And he insisted that they hadn't changed anything and that everyone had known all along that this is what the Second Amendment meant and that the Supreme Court didn't change its view. And the moderator finally said, you know, he's accused you, pointing at me, of being the Thurgood Marshall of gun rights. Why aren't you taking that accolade? And I think it was hard for him to turn it down, but he insisted that that was what he was doing. So Justice Stevens's dissent, there were two dissents. One was Stevens, who said, here's the real history. I think he had the better of the history. Although his focus was so much on the continuity between the militias and the National Guard, but I think it was a consequential strategic choice to focus on trying to do better originalism. Because, I don't think that's actually the right way to understand how this or most other constitutional provisions should be read. Justice Breyer did a second dissent. He sort of threw up his hands. He said, sure, it's an individual right. What then? How do we decide what laws are allowed? And he went through kind of a balancing test, and it is actually Justice Breyer's dissent rather than Justice Scalia's majority opinion that has had the greater impact in the real world on how other courts have ruled.
Ben Kohler, do you or your center have much of a sense of how all-encompassing or restrictive the court and other courts, Supreme Courts, tend to be in researching in preparation to make their decisions?
It's a great question. Well, you know, the Supreme Court, they get deluged with all these friend of the court briefs. They have, especially when they try to do originalism, it's sort of amateur historical work. Judge Richard Posner, who is a very prominent conservative judge who has been a bitter critic of the Heller decision, as a lot of conservative judges and lawyers have been, he said that the purported historical research that Justice Scalia used only shows the ability of well-staffed courts to produce a historical snow job. Those were his words. Scalia responded that he was a liar, and it was a good thing they didn't have guns, you know. The courts, in the work the Brennan Center does, we focus in our work on the systems of democracy and justice, especially on voting and the assault on the right to vote that we've seen in states all across the country, on campaign finance and the radical decisions the court has made in recent years, striking down one after another campaign finance law. Our view is, as I sort of said at the end of my talk, that it's a mistake for lawyers, it's especially a mistake for kind of progressive lawyers, to think that the best footnotes and the best brief is how you're going to win. The courts respond, as we all do, to public movements, to public argument, to broad changes in public understanding. So that when it comes, for example, to voting rights, the Brennan Center, as you know, in 2011, 19 states passed 24 new laws making it harder for people to vote for the first time since the Jim Crow era. It happened in plain view, but people didn't really notice that it was happening. We were able to do a report that showed that it was that these legal changes could make it much harder for as many as 5 million people to vote. That helped create a big debate, fostered a fierce public argument. And that public argument, focusing on these voting issues, began to change the terrain on which these decisions got made. So that by the time we and the other civil rights and voting rights groups went to court in the spring of 2012, every single one of those worst laws was blocked or blunted or postponed or repealed. And it didn't matter if it was a Republican judge or a Democratic judge, a federal judge or a state judge, every one, because the public argument had shifted. And so that broad, you know, it's really the Constitution, as the story of the Second Amendment tells us, is not up to the judges or the lawyers. It's really up to all of us, and always has been, how we see it, what we think it means. And so, you know, political consultants, I was in government and politics for a long time, they'll always tell you, oh, nobody cares about this stuff. Nobody cares about all this Supreme Court stuff, this constitutional stuff. That's nonsense. People care about it deeply and can be made to care about it.
Go ahead.
I'm Carolyn Poplin. We met a week and some ago at the American Constitution Society.
Yes.
You've already signed my book. This was a great talk. You haven't mentioned the gun manufacturers, and I was wondering what you thought there. I went to school in Connecticut. That's Remington and Smith & Wesson, and I think some others. How important do you think that was?
It's a great question about the gun manufacturers and their role, and I get asked that question quite a bit. I guess I would say that the role of gun manufacturers is less than you might suppose. The gun manufacturers have begun to contribute to the NRA, but only in the last 10, 12 years or so, because they're afraid of the NRA members when Smith & Wesson actually made a deal with the Clinton administration to ship trigger locks with guns to prevent children from using them, they faced a boycott from NRA members. And the Business Week magazine has done a terrific job covering this. The gun manufacturers sort of scampered away in fear and began supporting the NRA. But the power of the NRA is not from the gun industry. It's not even from campaign spending. It's from it's not even from the size of the NRA, because it's a big institute. It's a big group. It's got about 3 million members, I think. We don't really know. But the AARP has 30 million members. That's, you know, it's a big country. It's the intensity. It's the intensity with which gun rights adherents will vote for you or against you only based on this issue. It's the willingness of members of the Senate to vote on Supreme Court nominations based on how somebody is scored by the NRA, even if they have no record, you know. I don't think it's the money from the gun industry. I think it's the intensity of the people in that movement.
Thanks.
Jim McGee. I was really intrigued by the way you handled the debate around the Second Amendment in the first part of your book, and how it parallels today's debates around militias and all that kind of stuff. But I was wondering if you could talk to the issue of, or to the topic of, the armory movement, the National Guard, and how that played, how the labor movement fed into all that.
You know, one of the neat things about this is that if you follow the life history of the Second Amendment, it's sort of like Zelig or something. It pops up in all these interesting parts of American history. As I said, the militias, pretty much that militia system faded away. And the courts ruled in the early part of the 1800s, generally speaking, ruled that the Second Amendment didn't recognize an individual right or wasn't focused, at least on the federal government. Things kind of popped up again around the time of the Civil War, because, of course, there were militias then. They were called into service by Lincoln or by the South at the beginning of the Civil War, and then pretty quickly they turned to armies. After the Civil War, one of the twists and turns is that at the time of the 14th Amendment, the freed slaves, the freedmen, were being terrorized by the Klan and other white vigilantes. One of the purposes of some of the framers of the 14th Amendment was to make sure they could get guns. Now, having said that, they also, the military governments that then ruled the South during the military phase of Reconstruction, also had very strict gun control laws. So it's even that's a bit of a jumble. One of the cases in front of the Supreme Court dealt with who could organize a militia. Could anybody organize a militia, or did the government have to organize it? And it was actually a socialist militia of German workers out in Illinois said, we're a militia too. We have our Second Amendment rights. And the Supreme Court ruled, no, it's only the government that has a militia. So when you hear Clive and Bundy say, or others now in the modern militia movement saying, well, a militia is anybody who wants to stand up against the government, waves their gun around, and that's what the framers meant. It's not only not what the courts have ruled, it's not really what the framers meant either, because they, of course, created the Constitution in part in response to Shays' Rebellion, which was an armed sort of mini insurrection against the government in western Massachusetts. And their purpose was to centralize military authority in this new government. And when, as the Second Amendment was being ratified, the Whiskey Rebellion happened in western Pennsylvania, and people said, see, we have our militia. And George Washington showed up with the other militia and said, not anymore, you don't. So, and crushed it. The only time a U.S. president has led troops in battle. So, you know, there's a lot of misremembered history that goes on, but the question of what is a militia is one of them. And as I said, in 1902, Congress created the National Guard system. That's what the framers' generation would have called a select militia. It's not everybody. It's basically, you know, it's a small group. And we move toward a modern military with an army and the kinds of things that would have terrified the framers.
Thank you.
Picking up on your theme about the building a political movement around regulation of guns, the examples that everybody thinks of when they think of arguments for gun control are the sort of 30-shot magazine rounds and the assault rifles and all those sorts of things. Yet the majority of the people of those 30,000 people who are killed every year are killed by a handgun. Just sort of how do you've thought about this, I'm sure, a lot more than the rest of us. How do you build a political movement when the images aren't sort of true, the images, that the horror show that everybody thinks about isn't in fact the main problem?
It's a great question, because it's these public atrocities that, to the degree there's energy for gun control laws, they're driven by public violence. It used to be political assassinations, now it's these mass shootings. But that isn't the everyday risk of violence that people face, either in terms of within the home or self-inflicted violence, or even in crime-ridden areas of the cities. And it's important that there not be, in the wake of something like Newtown, a sort of emotionalism in response. We don't want to duplicate in the war on guns the kinds of mistakes people made in the war on drugs. That's why I think that an area where there is both more consensus but also less constitutional concern has to do with this idea of only keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. And you know, this is where there's this intersection with the mental health system and the challenges of mental health. Most of those, a lot of those are either domestic violence or suicide. And there are, you know, the answers aren't going to come from gun control laws. Although part of fixing the mental health system is making sure that people who might hurt themselves or others don't get access to guns. The main thing that has to happen is there has to be an ability to show that the NRA or the gun rights folks do not have such a lock on things that they can block everything. That's why it was too bad in a way that last year the assault weapons ban debate happened at the same time as the background check debate, because there was never a chance that was going to pass. It made it easy for people to say, oh, see, this is the first step, they're going to come take your guns away. I think that focusing on things about who can get access to guns and on modernizing the way we treat mental illness as it relates to firearm possession. You know, in places, if you are involuntarily committed, that can prevent you from getting access to a gun. But obviously, there are lots of people with all kinds of concerns who that doesn't apply to, including, by all accounts, this guy out in California, where you can't really say the system didn't, you can't really say he fell through the cracks. He had a lot of attention to him, but there was nothing there that would say, well, this guy shouldn't be able to buy a gun. So
we're going to have our last two questions of people standing in line.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. First of all, thank you for this very important work.
Thank you.
I'm struck by even though you say the gun industry is willing to discuss, and I was wondering, isn't there a major difference between the Second Amendment and civil rights and other movements, that the gun industry provided an ample source of funds, and that makes it possible to stir up the membership, that any, and of course the gun industry does better, the fewer the limits on weapons, ammunition, etc. So it's easy to stir up the membership, that any limitation which will inevitably lead to your guns being taken away.
So, I only know about, all I know about the role of the gun industry is what I've read in journalistic and other accounts. And while it is now supporting the NRA financially, and that may be an increasingly influential part of that movement, it wasn't what the original source of their energy was. And it seems to be a relatively recent thing. And while it's true that they make money, the more people are afraid someone's going to take their gun away, the more sales there are. It's interesting that there are all kinds of economic counter pressures that one can imagine. So that, for example, you've started to see investors saying they don't want their investments in gun manufacturers, just as they might have done with tobacco firms or others. But you also have seen concerns over liability helping to shape the reaction of major companies toward some of the things that are going on. So you all probably are familiar with the open carry movement. So this is, because there's this case that everybody thinks are going to happen at some point, there's a real desire to normalize the idea of carrying guns around. And so in Texas, among other places, you have state legislatures passing laws, such as in Georgia, to allow people to carry guns into churches and bars and little league fields. But in Texas, there's this group that is goes around carrying assault weapons into fast food restaurants and Target stores and other things. And it's really backfired. Even the NRA criticized, on its website, criticized it as weird, and then they had to retract that. But you're starting to see a lot of major stores and chains saying, we don't want you to bring guns in. Now, one would imagine there might be, that might be because they don't want their customers, generally speaking, being uncomfortable and wondering who that guy over there is with an assault weapon. But it also is the case that they probably are worried about liability if somebody gets shot in their store, and they don't say that. So there are all kinds of interesting economic pressures and counter pressures that go on. And I do wonder, you know, as people talk about this as a political issue, I do wonder if this open carry movement, if these videos of these citizens carrying their guns around really might be kindling something in the part of a lot of people. If there's something of a silent majority, especially women, reacting to that and saying, you know what, this is not what we have in mind. We don't know yet, but some brave and courageous politician will test it and see.
You have a question?
Hi, my name is Zaina. So you talked about how the NRA as sort of their first step to change public opinion and affect constitutional change, that they use scholarship. My question is how proponents of stricter gun laws can do something similar when the NRA has effectively prevented them from doing so by limiting the government's ability to fund gun violence research.
Great question. So there's two parts to the answer. So one is you're exactly right that there were actually legislative riders that prevented both the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health from doing research on gun violence and its causes and its consequences. You know, I talked about cars. Well, there's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration doing that research. There's nothing equivalent on guns, although the auto industry wasn't wild about that either way back when. And this is especially important now that it's all in court, because you need to be able to prove that there's a real government interest in this or that or another restriction. Some of the answers, this is one thing that the Obama administration has done, is lifted some of these restrictions. Some of the answer actually has to come, unfortunately or fortunately, from private philanthropy, and this is where former Mayor Bloomberg has actually, through his support of Johns Hopkins and other schools, actually stepped in as he can where the taxpayers couldn't to fund some of this. But that's one kind of research. There's another kind of research that, because of the kind of kooky way the courts are looking at this stuff now, is really important, which is historical research. I described the gun laws of the colonial era. There's actually a lot of research that needs to be done, more research on what the actual gun laws were in the 1700s, the 1800s, and the 1900s, to buttress the idea of, well, what were the gun laws? You know, was it this libertarian thing, or were there actually lots of different gun laws? There's a historian named Saul Cornell at Fordham, who's been a real pioneer in this. But this is the kind of thing that, if these cases are going to go, for example, the question of whether guns can be carried, a lot of early gun laws treated carrying a gun outside the home very differently from being in a home. And there weren't so many cases on them because they weren't controversial, or they weren't seen as a constitutional issue. So there's that kind of scholarship that's needed, too, to tell us what the real story is. And who knows, it may turn out that they didn't have the gun laws, but I suspect it'll turn out otherwise.
Michael, thank you. This was a wonderful, wonderful session, not only on the Second Amendment, but looking ahead in shorthand, how to take the Breyer approach that will uphold legislative bodies that do fact-based work on guns and campaign finance and voting rights, as opposed to the Scalia approach, which will just bring us back to the days of liberty of contract, when people overturned the minimum wage law and things of that sort. So this was remarkable for how to look ahead with historic background. Michael is here to sign books. You can see he's a good conversationalist. So line up, help us with the chairs, and we'll have a good time.